Hello and welcome to Voices from the SBS Summit, brought to you by the National Insider Threat Task Force. My name is David Prina, and I'm a behavioral research scientist with the Threat Lab. Today, Dr. Anne Speckard and Molly Ellenberg and I are continuing the conversation we started in September during the Counter Insider Threat Social and Behavioral Sciences Summit. Hi, Anne and Molly. How have you both been since the summit?
Great, thank you. Great. It's so nice to be back with you.
All right. Well, I hope all of our listeners have watched the recording of your webcast, The Insider Threat of Violent Extremist Culture on Military Culture and the Wider Society, which is available on sbssummit.com. But for those of you who haven't, would you mind telling us a bit about yourselves and the work that you do?
My name is Molly Ellenberg. I'm a research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. So as Anne will tell you, she does amazing in-depth psychological interviews with hundreds and hundreds of violent extremists and terrorists. And then I am the data person. I content code all of the interviews, do all of the data analysis, and I also work on our counter-narrative project on Facebook.
And I'm Anne Speckard, the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. And I've been studying terrorists for over 20 years and in-depth interviewed about 800 of them. Most recently, 273 of ISIS, 16 of Al-Shabaab, 50 of white supremacists. Not necessarily terrorists. And I do in-depth interviews that include a life history, how they got on the terrorist trajectory, what their experiences in the terrorist or extremist group were, and if they got disillusioned or they got arrested, how they got out, if they de-radicalized, how that process happened, what things were needed. And I've been studying this for years and years, and Molly and I read up all kinds of scientific articles about what we're studying.
So in your summit presentation, you talked about the vulnerabilities that violent extremists try to exploit to recruit both current and former service members. So let's pick up where we left off. And let me ask you about some of your interviews. So you've interviewed a number of extremists and former extremists who have been members of the U.S. military. Some of them have become extremists after leaving the military, while others try to join the military after they already held extreme beliefs. So for those who turn to extremism after leaving the military, what are some of the common motivators that you found?
After people leave the military, those who are vulnerable to radicalization and recruitment by violent extremists, specifically white supremacists, more often than not, I would say in most cases, have a major need for purpose and significance and belonging that was often previously filled by their military service. That sense of doing something noble and great, as well as having a brotherhood, a unit that one could trust and feel accepted by. And so the transition into civilian life can feel as though all of that is being taken away. And so white supremacist recruiters see that as an opening and an opportunity to come in and offer them a chance to A, have new camaraderie, and B, often they phrase it or frame it as continuing a patriotic noble cause, as something that it's continuing to fight enemies of the United States. They posit it as enemies that are domestic, government figures that are orchestrating the downfall of the white race, things like that. But they're still framing it as a noble cause. In some cases, however, we do see people who are disaffected by the U.S. government, who feel as though they were abandoned, as though they have PTSD that wasn't well treated. Oftentimes, they come back from war and are unemployed. Those who were coming back from Iraq in the middle of an economic recession found that, you know, the jobs that had been available before they joined the military are gone. And so that feeling of disaffection and disillusionment can also be preyed upon by white supremacists who say that the U.S. government isn't taking care of you because it's controlled usually by Jews, that you were off fighting Israel's wars and your friends were dying for this cause that is a Jewish cause. It's not even yours. And so that way they can bring them in from an anti-government perspective as well.
And I would say, too, we've seen cases where a former soldier has had PTSD and really likes being in a group that's involved in conflict, street fighting, attacking minorities, because it feels normal. When you have PTSD, you're in a high arousal state, you feel in danger, and it doesn't match if you're living in a normal, quiet life. But if you get out in a gang or in gang violence, then you feel like, okay, my bodily and emotional state is matching. And in the case of skinheads, there's oftentimes a lot of drinking. We know that drinking is sometimes a coping mechanism because it can ward off the flashbacks, help the vet to sleep the entire night. And so these things can pull them in. And then all the vulnerabilities that Molly just listed, from the point of view of the group likes to have military people and use them as recruiters because they can then position themselves as, look, we're patriotic. We have all these soldiers. And they value these people who are at a point in their life when they need to be valued for any weapons training that they can give, tactical kind of training, maybe even access to weapons, knowledge about weapons. And so people that are looking for a noble cause and significance are getting it from the recruiter.
That's very interesting. So it seems like there's kind of two different things going on. They're experiencing some kind of relative deprivation, and there's kind of a shock of the transition from military to civilian life. And then there's also some sort of pull factors where these groups or the ideologies promise something, promise to fill some sort of unfulfilled need.
Absolutely. And I know Jeff Shipp from the National Socialist Movement, which is basically the Nazi Party of America, reworked, said that he really valued to take people from the military because they were disciplined, they were hard workers, and if he could convince them this was a patriotic cause, they were great. And they were used to a rank structure, and his group worked on a rank structure. So when they would move people up the ranks, these military guys loved it.
So it sounds like there are some real human factors that are going into people who were in the military and then go down an extremism route afterwards. One of the things that people will probably note is that extremist beliefs can be really shocking and disturbing. And so for the people that you interviewed, especially people who turned to extremism after the military, was it really the beliefs themselves that brought people into the ideology? Because it sounds like it wasn't really the beliefs. It sounds like there were these other pull factors. So if you can talk to me a little bit about the role of the ideology.
It's really very rare that we find the ideology that's pushing somebody into the group, or that's even a pull factor, because they're often not recruited through the ideology either. And so many of these groups, their primary enemy are Jews, and so many of people who join have never even met a Jewish person. So they're not driven by ideology very often. What happens, rather, we find in a process that we call directed hate, is when the people join through this need, these, as you've said, really human universal needs that all of us have for belonging, for purpose, for meaning in our lives. They join, the group offers them this and says that you are special because you're white, and threatens the loss of that specialness, that others are trying to orchestrate the downfall of the white race, you, your children, and your children's children. This is something that you need to fight for. They're brought in really through acceptance and a sense of significance, but then told that if they don't adhere to this ideology, that there will be penalties, not necessarily from the group. It could be the group is saying you need to believe this or you're out. But also that if you don't fight for this, all of this sense of significance is gone.
So directed hate starts with, you're special. We're an elite group. This is whites only. And you get to be part of it. And you should be proud of yourself. And not only that, all those failures you've had in your lives, those aren't your fault. Those are the faults of minorities. And behind them are the Jews. So they bring you in, addressing your failures as something you can blame on others, and telling you that you're conferring dignity onto you and belonging and noble purpose. And then saying, but this is our ideology and you must belong to it. And they punish them if they don't. So, you know, some guys sneak around and date minorities, but they have to hide it. You're not allowed to hang around with minorities. And you're called to support violent actions and disgusting rhetoric that the group puts out. That's the cost of belonging. And if you don't go along with it, then you lose all of the benefits that you've gained and that you really needed, because you came out of a need for belonging, significance, and purpose in your life, but then you were directed into hate. And a lot of people take the hate on. So it's definitely their violent actions and their hateful actions are ideologically driven, but their trajectory into the group is not ideologically driven.
I find that very interesting because I think a lot of people might think, well, it sounds like the hate must have been within them beforehand, but you're saying that there's a different process there, especially for the people who joined, who were military and then became extremists.
What I would say is if there was hate before, it was this background hate of growing up with white supremacism in your family, in your community. So it was acceptable and segregation was acceptable to you. And also with a lot of these people, they come from really adverse childhood backgrounds and they may never put it into words, but there's a feeling of failure, a sense of self-hatred that's very easily directed to the other.
Yeah, so it's kind of there, but they've never necessarily acted upon it, or it's easy to activate upon someone else jumping in. We talked about two different kind of routes here, people who were military and then became extremists. Then there's also the other route, which is people who are extremists and then join the military. And do you see any differences in motivations for that group of folks?
The needs of joining in the first place are really not very different, because the people who are in the extremist group before they join the military also initially join the extremist group to fill these needs. But their motivation to join the military is often quite different. They're going in to get training. Militant jihadists, as well as white supremacists, have been known to join the military, although the jihadists more to mount insider attacks, gain information, things like that, whereas white supremacists are more looking to join in order to get weapons training, tactical training, to recruit other people in the group. And so the screening that happens is not necessarily very effective, because these groups do get their members into the military. They are able to do that.
One of the things that these groups teach is that there's going to be a race war at some point, and that the whites will boot out the liberals and who they claim are the Jews, the Zionist organized occupied government, Islamic. So there will be a race war. And for that reason, it's really important for these groups to place people into the military, partly for them to get training and bring it back out to share with the rest of the group, and partly to stay in the military. They want them in military, police, government, judges, to help their groups in the here and now, and also in the dreamed for future when the racial holy war will happen, Rahoa. And if they have highly placed important people, especially in the military, they dream that they'll be able to overthrow the government and install a whites-only government.
So you talked about these two different routes into the military of people who join before, then join after, or extremism rather. But I want to know, what is the extent of this problem? Is it a consistent pipeline for disaffected or isolated veterans? Is there a large number of extremists who are trying to join the military? What's your sense?
It's a growing problem. It's still a small percentage, both of white supremacists who have military experience and of military members who become white supremacists. We know that about 10% of hate crime offenders over the past 10 years, according to the BIAS data set from the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, about 10% of hate crime offenders have military experience, but that number has grown exponentially over the past 10 years. So 20 years ago, it was not nearly that high. But of course, 10% is about proportional to the number of people in the general population who have military experience. However, we've heard in our interviews that the number of hate crime offenders who are caught is probably much smaller than the number of people in these groups that do have military experience, which we've heard numbers in these interviews from 30% to 70% of specific organizations within the groups, the bodyguards, the stormtroopers, are recruited because they have military experience. But we also know there was a survey done by Military Times in 2019, I believe. They found that 18% of military members said that they had witnessed or heard expressions of white supremacy in the ranks. And in 2020 or 2021, it was a future survey, it was up to about 36%. So even though that's still the minority, it's a growing problem.
I would say we've also had this spreading through society in a number of ways. One, it's been more normalized and mainstream. Judge Shoup and Tam Garrett, both leaders of different groups, told us about how they started to change their clothing. They started going for people having less of a skinhead look. and ran for political offices, own to mainstream it into society that this is acceptable and sort of like Black Lives Matter, will White Lives Matter too kind of thing. And also we've seen how the internet has changed, that nowadays people can jump on platforms like Zoom, they can Skype with each other, they can text. So I always say there's four things that go into making a terrorist, and this also votes for extremists, that you need a group, an ideology, social support, and then the vulnerabilities and motivations of the person. Well, the social support, it used to be you got it in person, and there were some risks to letting a newcomer come and join your group if you were engaged in any kind of violent activities. Well, that's less true for white supremacists, but nowadays you can get this group instantly forming around you. And the algorithms on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube will make that even more possible, Instagram, because whatever we show an attraction to, they give us more of, whether it's fancy shoes or a disgusting group. So the increase is there. And then we also have had politicians endorse this, and we've also had QAnon. And QAnon has played into a lot of these things about patriotism, that there's this evil other. And there's been a lot of overlap between QAnon and white supremacists, with the idea that for some, following QAnon, that it's a fight between good and evil, that it's end times, and for others that it's a liberal conservative battle, but over values and good and evil. But it gets mixed in with this white supremacy in many cases. So all of the, and then again, we've had politicians straight out endorsing QAnon. So these things all have led to an increase in this domestic terrorist threat from the white supremacist issue.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, too, about the kind of social acceptability of some of the precepts that accompany extremism. Because we often encounter, at least in some of the research I do, that people aren't aware some of the talking points or phrases or countercultural talking points are actually planted or originate with some white supremacist groups. Like, I think the White Lives Matter and then White Boy Summer, there are some terms that originate, but people aren't actually aware of that. And so they take it on and it turns into something different.
The kind of dog whistles where the people who know references, anytime you hear a reference to George Soros funding something, George Soros is a Jewish billionaire and he's very frequently the face of this satanic Jewish cabal that's controlling things. And he funds a lot of liberal causes. But the dog whistles end up going to the people who already know, but also then spreading to the people who don't know, who kind of take it in, like you were saying, like the White Lives Matter, like the White Boy Summer, like coded things about wokeism that seep in more slowly. And people take on an ideology without really realizing that it is based in hatred until they're kind of already in.
We have seen this mainstreaming of really even lethal ideas in other terrorist groups. Like, for instance, when the Second Intifada happened in Israel, Palestinians turned to suicide terrorism and they said, well, you've got fighter jets, Apaches, and so on from the U.S., all we have is our bodies, we strap bombs on, and we go to explode ourselves. And this got popularized because at first, people were saying, no, suicide's not allowed in Islam. But then there became this slippery slope of, well, with the Palestinians, you know, they have an argument with the Israelis. Everyone serves in the army eventually, so we could say they were all militarized. And then Al-Qaeda joined this and started mainstreaming the idea of suicide terrorism. So I made interviews all through Europe asking Muslims about their levels of radicalization. And one question was, do you endorse suicide terrorism, and in what circumstances? Maybe not using those exact words, but you would hear a high endorsement for Palestinians using it. And this was something that changed in a decade, that it got mainstreamed into acceptance in certain circumstances instead of this is a heinous act of murder.
Thank you for bringing up the example of the Intifada, which for our listeners was a Palestinian uprising against the Israeli authorities. And I think that's a very interesting point that you bring that up about the idea of an acceptability of suicide bombing. Because what you're saying is that there's this larger kind of extremist landscape. And oftentimes when we talk about extremism, especially when it comes to very trusted institutions like law enforcement or military, people are very reluctant to be critical of people within those institutions being extremists. And they tend to use terms like there's just a few bad apples. So I wanted to know, is there harm in viewing it as isolated bad apple cases?
There's absolutely harm in seeing it as isolated. No matter how small the actual number is, it's still happening in a systemic way in that white supremacists are actively recruiting and radicalizing members of the military and members of law enforcement for all of these goals that we've explained. And that acceptability is so key to the reasons why they want to spread their ideology into these trusted institutions, especially these trusted institutions that are so rarely questioned, that if this ideology is believed by police, by soldiers, then is it really wrong? Is it really anti-American? Is it really illegal? Is it really extremist? And they can say, no, it's not. It's patriotic. It's legitimate, as long as they have these people. And so the idea that it would only be a small percentage doesn't negate the circumstances surrounding it.
I would say also that when you have a bad apple and it's spreading its poison and its rot through the whole bunch of apples by being there and not being plucked out, you don't know how it's going to spread and who it's going to spread to. And the more mentally unstable the person is, the more they want to earn that badge of belonging, purpose, heroism, full sense of dignity. They may become the next Stalin Ruth or Anders Breivik and go and shoot up a synagogue, go and shoot up a church. So we shouldn't look at these as isolated cases because oftentimes they're very interconnected. We see one person attacking, referencing the other. And the same thing is going to be true in the military, that if somebody in my unit thinks this is okay, well, then maybe it's okay. Because as human beings, we follow this thing called the looking glass self, that we look in the mirror of other people and if it's acceptable, then we think, oh, okay, then it's acceptable for me too. And it's very concerning.
And one thing I want to ask you about as well is, so I think there might be a fear that people, researchers or people who are partisan, might be taking it too far and saying that extremism is pervasive within the ranks, right? It's everywhere. But I think there's something else that you're saying here is that there's vulnerabilities that the military or certain institutions like the military have to extremism. And if so, what are some of those vulnerabilities that you see in military life, administration, or culture that make people vulnerable to extremism?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that it's not that every single member of the military is an extremist. But I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was mentioning these different things that would drive people to join the military that might also drive them to join extremist groups on another path. And that's absolutely what we have seen, is that people who join the military have the great strengths that they add to the military, that they have a very strong sense of good and evil, sort of a moral absolutism. They have a sense, whether they have it coming in or whether they have it after training, of discipline, of structure, respect for authority. And all of that is very useful to a white supremacist group. And all of that can make a white supremacist group seem very appealing as well.
We should credit our military, though, that it is a place where minorities have been treated really well and that you can rise to the top. And I think many minorities have had great careers in the military and would say that it's largely a colorblind institution. So bravo to our military for doing a really good job on integration. But there still is the issue that there are people, just like in the general society, that are getting pulled into white supremacism or are joining because they want what the military can offer to them as people and as members of a group.
And one thing in particular that I wanted to focus in on too is the role of trauma in a lot of interviewees' lives. And this is something that is in a lot of the interviews that you've done with people and their sort of past histories. Can you tell me a little bit more about what trauma does and what kind of vulnerabilities it creates, if any?
Yeah, trauma creates many, many vulnerabilities. And that's not to say that everybody who experiences trauma in their life will go on to be an extremist or criminal. We find this all the time whenever there is talk of trauma and the kind of trajectory into violent behavior, that we don't want to generalize. But what trauma does is it creates these needs that aren't met in childhood, that aren't met through therapy after the trauma, whether it's a lack of feeling supported, a lack of feeling like you matter, like you're worthy, like you're valued, a lack of a positive sense of identity. Somebody who has been abused or the victim of any number of different types of traumatic experiences might feel a great sense of purposelessness and insignificance that then creates that opening for radicalization that will offer them exactly what they need, what they really should have gotten through social services, through their families, through psychotherapy, through good trauma counseling. And when that doesn't happen, then these groups can come in as seemingly very good alternatives.
We've talked about push and pull factors and unfulfilled needs. And I kind of wanted to bring this back around to security and workforce protection, which is, what are some things that you think the military can do to reduce or mitigate the threat of extremism? How can they fill those needs or address those kind of vulnerability?
Yeah, so filling those needs is something that the military already does pretty well when the people are in. It does give people a sense of belonging and purpose and dignity and significance. Often the issue is that that is taken away so abruptly after discharge. And so support for veterans in that regard can be really effective as a buffer against radicalization and recruitment by violent extremist groups, because the veteran feels like they still have support and that they still have an identity, membership in veteran organizations, things like that. But there's also been a lot written about screening procedures that just aren't as effective as they could be. Typically, the screening for violent extremists is that question that anyone who's done a government form, have you ever been a part of a group that was fighting against the government of the United States or aiding an adversary? A, you could lie. B, if you think that your group is a patriotic pro-American group that's only trying to protect Western civilization and white heritage in the U.S., then your honest answer is no. And that also, of course, doesn't get at people who might be very vulnerable to radicalization once they're already in. And so improving the screening to ask about more underlying beliefs and ideologies, looking at people's social media before they come in and after to see gestures, symbols, clothing, tattoos, because, you know, it's more than just a swastika tattoo that you might find. It's something that might be a lot more obscure. And so being able to screen out extremists and to keep an eye on what's happening once people have already joined, and making sure that their social media isn't reflecting any new extremist beliefs, all of that can definitely be improved and would make a big difference.
That's all great. And I would say we want to assess prior to people joining, and we want to do continuous assessment. So commanders all need some kind of training to figure out, are they seeing things? Because there can be symbols, or as Molly put it earlier, dog whistles, that if you don't have any idea what that means, you wouldn't know you have a white supremacist in your ranks. There's talk now, and I think it's a great idea, of doing some kind of automatic, probably machine learning assessment of social media of people that are in the ranks. You know, we give up lots of rights to serve in the military, including agreeing to be deployed to conflict zones, take vaccinations, and probably your social media needs to be available to be assessed, because people put stupid things on social media that give them away as white supremacists or as other kinds of insider threats, and that can be caught easily. And then we have to think, how do we train the people that get this information to do something useful with it and address the issue of reporting? Because if you know that one of your comrades is a white supremacist, you probably know it because you've either been his victim or he's your friend. And if he's your friend, you might not want to report him because you don't want him to get booted out. If you're his victim, you might not want to report him because you don't want the retaliation that might come to you if he does get booted out. So the answer to that is to think about, can we do things that are serious measures that say we're taking this threat to the cohesiveness of the military seriously? It's very important. But can we turn people around through good psychological care? And we've had in our sample people tell us that they were sent to psychologists and the psychologist was afraid of them or had no idea how to deal with them, didn't understand what was going on with them. So again, that gets back to training, so that there are qualified specialists to deal particularly with this. and hopefully not have to eject people from the military, but treat it somewhat like alcoholism, drug abuse issues. They've got one chance. If you're willing to turn yourself around and come back and be a member of a cohesive unit and uphold that cohesiveness, we'll work with you. If you're not, you'll be out. But then we have to also think through the whole issue of, if you're the organization that weapons trained these people, if you're foisting them back out to the greater society, what are we supposed to do with these people?
Yeah, I appreciate that sort of holistic approach that you both mentioned here. There's many ways to approach it, and it could be a multi-level approach as well. And I know this is a very tough subject, and with extremism, it is pretty dark. But I wanted to give you the last word here on, are there any stories that you've encountered in your many, many interviews with extremists that give you some hope that people can turn away from extremism?
Many. I can think of one that always sticks out to me, who was actually, had been in the army, had been discharged, felt very disaffected, was recruited into skinhead organization, or the Hammer Skins. He's in prison. He was attacked by rival gang members. And the Area Brotherhood did nothing to help him. He felt totally betrayed. And the only person who did help him was his Black cellmate, who taught him not only how to survive prison, but was also giving him tons of books and materials and literature that really opened up his eyes. And when he got out of prison, he ended up becoming a city council candidate, running on an environmental justice platform. So he really did change his whole belief system. And I think what that highlights, not only that people can change, but the power of one person reaching out and being kind and connecting with someone. And it's very hard for us to say it's the responsibility of minorities to be nice to white supremacists, because it's not. It's not their job. It's not their responsibility. But we see over and over and over again that individual interpersonal interactions with people that used to be hated others can make a huge difference in changing these people's lives.
We have another case, Sean Gillespie, who was in the military, and he kept taking part in his extremist activities and first got a warning and then got kicked out. And he went on to carry out attacks on minorities and on a synagogue. So, you know, here's a failure of the military. They got him out of their ranks, but didn't protect the rest of society. And when Sean finally did get an intervention in prison and was offered psychological help, he had tried to kill himself. He had been violent in prison as well. But when he finally got help, most of it went back to that he had been molested as a child, had all kinds of anger, had never gotten the help that he needed from it, and then was easy prey for a white extremist group that told him, you're important, you have a mission. The fault of the abuse that happened here goes back to the Jews. So, of course, he's going through life hating the Jews, and all this anger redirected. Here you see the directed hate. But when he got an intervention, he changed. And now he is a mixed martial arts fighter. He's out of prison, and he's working with you and sensitive and caring public speaker. And both of these people took part in our Escape Hate Counter-Narrative project, which is where, when we do these interviews, we have 50 so far of white supremacists. Most of them have agreed to speak against their groups and against white supremacism. And they basically tell a story in about 5 minutes, and sometimes it could have been as short as 1 minute, to tell what their grievance was, what their trajectory into the group was, what they thought the group was offering them, and then what the reality was, how it poisoned their lives, and warning others, don't get into this. And these are the kind of things that can be used in the military. It can be used for prevention. Facebook is our partner, putting them out with us. And we're really hopeful that messages from people that have been in these groups are very credible and can reach people that are vulnerable like they once were, to stop them from going in and maybe shake them up enough to look for help to get out.
Well, thank you both very much for those stories. And I think really highlight the possibilities that there's something that can come after hate. I think that's very powerful and important to know. All right. Well, thank you all for listening, and a big thanks to our speakers, Dr. Ann Speckard and Molly Ellenberg. As I mentioned at the beginning, to listen to Ann and Molly's summit presentation, please visit sbssummit.com. Also, don't miss out on new products from the Threat Lab. Sign up for our distribution list at dodhra.threatlab@mail.mil.